This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross.
Dusty Springfield!
Some critics consider Dusty Springfield the best British female rock singer of the 60s. She had many hits in England and America, including Wishin' and Hopin', I Only Want to Be With You, I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, and The Look of Love. A CD and DVD of her 1979 performance at the Royal Albert Hall, with Princess Margaret in attendance, has recently been released. From that concert, here's one of her biggest hits. That's an excerpt from Dusty Springfield Live at the Royal Albert Hall, which has just come out on CD and DVD. Springfield died of cancer in 1999, just before her 60th birthday. Springfield's authorized biography, Dancing with Demons, described the personal life that few of her fans knew about, including the fact that she was a lesbian. In 2002, Terry Gross spoke with the book's co-author, Vicky Wickham, who was Springfield's longtime friend and manager. Wickham produced the British TV music program Ready, Steady, Go, which Springfield appeared on and later co-hosted. And she also co-wrote one of Springfield's hits, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Vicky Wickham met the singer when Springfield made a guest appearance on Ready, Steady, Go.
It was a chaotic show which went out every week on Associated Rediffusion Television, which was the independent channel, and it was subtitled The Weekend Starts Here. And we were a mixture of music, fashion, the celebrities of the time, pop art. And you have to remember, this was 1963. It was The Who, The Beatles, later Jimi Hendrix, The Animals. And we started bringing in American artists, Ike and Tina Turner, James Brown, Otis Redding. And it was live. It started off as a mimed show, but within a year went live. And every single week, we never quite got it right. It was a live in studio with an audience. And the cameras, I mean, literally would go between dancers, between the audience. And it just caught people's imagination. And kids would literally run home from school to see the show.
Yeah, it was kind of like American Bandstand, but with fashion and more interviews and things like that.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly what it was.
I mean, it's amazing. Like in the early days of Ready, Steady, Go, the Beatles would come on and then Ringo would dance in the audience with the other dancers.
Yeah. Exactly, which, you know, was amazing because they were huge at the time.
Right. Dusty Springfield is really an extraordinary singer. And, you know, I grew up listening to her records and, you know, I always liked her, but it was as an adult that I could really appreciate what a truly good singer she is. What struck you about her singing when you were auditioning people for Ready, Steady, Go?
She had a sound, and there are very few people that have a real sound to their voice. And Dusty's just one of those lucky ones that, you know, she's recognizable anywhere. She had an impeccable choice of material. She knew exactly what was right for her voice.
Her first hit, I Only Want to Be With You, came out in 1964 and debuted on Ready, Steady, Go. And this was while you were producing the program. What did you think of the record then? Did you think that was the right choice for her?
Yes, absolutely. It was a wonderful song and a great way to launch her.
Why don't we hear it?
Doesn't matter.
That's Dusty Springfield's first hit, I Only Want to Be With You. My guest is Vicki Wickham, who co-wrote Dancing with Demons, the authorized biography of Dusty Springfield. You actually co-wrote one of Dusty Springfield's songs, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, which was released in 1966. How did you come to co-write this song, and tell us if there's a story behind it?
Well, there is. Dusty had been at the San Remo Song Festival and came back with an Italian song that each time she was going to record, she'd say, I must write lyrics to it. She never did, so she never recorded it. And it came to the time in 64 where she said, I really need to record this song. And I, like a big mouth, said, well, any fool can write lyrics. So she said, well, okay, if any fool can write lyrics, go and write lyrics. And luckily, I was having dinner that night with a friend of mine. Actually, I was having dinner with him every night because we used to see each other all the time, Simon Napier-Bell, who was a musician. And I said to Simon, before we go to dinner, we have to do these lyrics for Dusty because she's recording tomorrow. So he said, okay, you know, play me the song. So we sat and played, and of course we sat and argued about what it should be and what it shouldn't. But it really, in about 30 minutes, we'd got the basis of it and then finished it off in the taxi. And the next day, when I was typing them up for Dusty, I called Simon and I said, these are horrible. I cannot give these to Dusty. And he said, well, what are you going to do? So I said, I suppose give them to Dusty because there's no choice. Like, so I think I sent them through or sent them over to Dusty or dropped them off or something. And she said, these are really bad. And I said, I know, we know that. Anyway, she recorded it. And of course, it went to number one.
Why did you think they were so bad, the lyrics?
They're really inane. And if you look at the lyrics, I think the word left is in there about six times. Although, you know, when you become familiar with them, you think, okay, they're not, perhaps not so bad.
So, well, why don't we hear the song and we'll let everybody judge what they think of the lyrics. It certainly did well for her and for you. You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, a 1966 hit by Dusty Springfield. My guest Vicki Wickham co-wrote the lyrics. She also co-wrote Dusty Springfield's biography called Dancing with Demons. Now, as you were getting to know Dusty Springfield, something that you learned about her was that she was a lesbian, and this was at a time when virtually no performers were really out of the closet, certainly not in pop music. How did you find out about that?
Well, because we were friends, so we were hanging out together. We, you know, had some of the same friends. We were beginning to have our own friends. And, you know, obviously, you know, you know what your friends are doing.
And are you gay too?
Yes, absolutely.
Did you have to keep each other's secrets? Did it need to be as big a secret for you as it was for her? Because you weren't a performer and could maybe afford to be a little more open.
Well, exactly. For me, it was never a problem because I wasn't in the public eye, and I was always openly gay, and it was absolutely fine. But for somebody like Dusty, it did matter. I mean, it was absolutely unheard of in 63, in the early 60s, and I really do think it would have harmed her at the time had people really known. You have to remember, too, the press in England, it's got worse over the years, but they're very intrusive. I mean, there are a lot of tabloids. As you know, we have about six or seven daily papers and then all the Sunday papers. So they need something to write about, and the more sensational it is, the better. The bigger name you are, obviously, the bigger story. And it was a real worry that, you know, the papers would start splashing it across.
And did people in the industry know and just keep it quiet, or were they clueless about it?
I think they mostly didn't know, and the few that did, you know, they weren't really particularly interested either. They were too busy with their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, your contemporaries don't care. It's really only the press and then the general public.
Dusty Springfield was from a Catholic family. She went to convent school. Did she feel guilty about her own sexual orientation?
Yes, she did. She felt guilty about a lot of things, and I think that the Catholic faith throughout her entire life always was a burden to her, and that was a large part of what the big problem was.
As a producer of Ready, Steady, Go, were you ever concerned that if she was outed, it would be a problem for the program?
No, not remotely. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it would have been. The only problem we ever had with Ready, Steady was when Donovan was busted for pot, and there was a whole discussion about whether we should have him on. I mean, how inane that sounds now, but that was the biggest problem we ever had.
Dusty Springfield really had a look in the 60s when she became a star. Why don't you describe the kind of fashion she wore, how she did her eyes, her hairdos?
Dusty had this huge bouffant hairdo, which required a lot of backcombing and a lot of spray, which we would sometimes laugh and say that she was responsible alone for the ozone layer. She also wore a lot of makeup. She looked at the fashion magazines and the film magazines of the time and would look at people like Monica Vitti, I suppose like a Bardo, that type of thing, and she followed their eye makeup, which was a lot of black, like a panda makeup, with a lot of heavy eyeliner above the lid as well as below. And dress-wise, she was what in those days was called a mod. You had mods and rockers. And Dusty was a mod with short skirts and skimpy little tops. I mean, she was very fashionable. You know, kids would emulate her.
Dusty Springfield recorded several Burt Bacharach, Hal David songs, such as I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, Wishing and Hoping, The Look of Love. How did she start to do Bacharach?
Dusty used to listen to a lot of demos from America. Publishers would send her demos. And, of course, she was going backwards and forwards to America to appear on shows, package shows, like at the ones at the Brooklyn Fox, where she would be on with Marvin Gaye, Martha and the Vandellas, The Searchers, The Animals, Dusty. So she was very conscious of American music. And she and I and Vic Billings, her manager at the time, went to Paris, and at the Olympia in Paris went to see Dionne Warwick, the Shirelles, little Stevie Wonder, who was singing Fingertips at the time. And she met Dionne Warwick, and we came back with heaps of records. So inevitably, a lot of those, of course, were Bacharach and David. In fact, all of them were Bacharach and David.
And she liked the songs and wanted to start recording them herself?
Loved the songs, yes.
So did she get in touch with Bacharach?
Yes. And I think that feels that her version of Look of Love is still the ultimate.
What do you think of her recording of that?
I think it's wonderful. I think it captures every essence of the song. It's beautiful.
Why don't we hear it?
The look of love is in your eyes. The look your heart can't disguise. The look just words can ever say. And what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arm around you. How long I have waited just to love you. Now that I have found you.
That's Dusty Springfield singing The Look of Love, which was from the film Casino Royale and was another big hit for her. The song was by Bacharach and David. Dusty Springfield did at least one of the songs that Dionne Warwick did as well. Dionne Warwick also did I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself. Did Dusty Springfield feel competitive with Dionne Warwick when it came to doing Burt Bacharach songs?
No, I think she loved Dionne's voice. She respected Dionne. She actually became friends with Dionne. I think she could have been slightly jealous that Dionne got the songs first from Burt and Hal, because, of course, Dionne was doing their demos and had first, you know, crack at the songs. But no, I don't think there was actually competitiveness, because Dusty would only do a song if she could do it her way, which she always did.
And do you know if Dionne Warwick felt competitive with Dusty Springfield?
Again, I don't think competitive is the right word. I would think pissed was the right word. I mean, if I were an American and had a great record and had success in the charts in America, and then some English bird was copying it and having success in England, I wouldn't be too happy.
Do you think Dionne Warwick saw it as copying her records?
Yes, I'm sure she did.
In the new authorized biography of Dusty Springfield, you write about her depressions. You say she was diagnosed as manic depressive, and her depressions were sometimes very severe. What was she like on either end of her mood swings?
She could go into the blackest moods ever, and very irrational in terms of nothing was right, nothing was good enough, including herself. Just really deep depressions, which would last sometimes for minutes, and it usually resulted in damaging some innate object of some sort. Never a danger to anybody else or at that point herself. And then on the other end, you know, when she'd come out of them, she was the most intelligent, wonderful, funny, interesting, up person imaginable. I mean, it's hard when she was her normal self, it was hard to imagine that she could possibly be any other way.
She also mutilated herself. She cut on her arms and legs. I think much more is known about that kind of self-mutilation now than was known then. It seems either more common or at least more publicly discussed. How did she and her doctors deal with it? And I don't know whether this was mostly in the 1960s or 70s.
It was both. At the time, you're right, I mean, not that much was known about it. And The biggest thing that I think was a mistake, and I mean, she felt the same way, she never found any help for it, meaning a shrink, a therapist. You know, the British are very anti that type of thing, especially in the 60s and 70s. I mean, we all felt that a good cup of tea would solve everything rather than going to talk to somebody. And of course, now we know better that, you know, it does help to have some professional advice and professional help. And at the time, nobody was really doing that. Even in terms of medication, none of the doctors were really prescribing anything, which nowadays, I don't know if it's Prozac or what they would give you, but they would give you something to help you get through it. At the time, nobody was doing that. So it became an occurrence which would happen far too frequently. And, you know, like with anything like that, it's a cry for help, and nobody was helping.
How did you find out about the cutting?
Various phone calls from emergency rooms or, you know, calls in the night from somebody or from Dusty herself. And, you know, it just, again, you know, none of us were qualified to help. You can offer support, you can, you know, help on that level, but it wasn't obviously enough.
Would the scars or the cuts show when she wore the kind of clothes she liked to wear? You know, was she in risk of performing with cuts and scars showing?
Yes, absolutely. And if you notice, she almost always, in fact, always would wear long sleeves.
And that's why?
Yes.
Would the depression go away when she was on stage?
It's interesting you should say that. Absolutely. Dusty, as much as she hated getting on stage, was scared stiff about it, once she got on stage, was A, the true professional, was absolutely wonderful, and thoroughly enjoyed herself.
Did you ever have to convince her to get on stage?
Constantly. It was always an uphill battle. I mean, as a manager, it really was very depressing sometimes that you'd have these wonderful offers, and I'd call her up and I'd say, okay, you know, this is what somebody wants you to do. Here are the pros, here are the cons. This is what the money is. This is what I, you know, should be. Let's talk about it. And it would always be no. Then I would get a call sort of 15 minutes later or 20 minutes later. Okay, you know, tell me more. What about, what if? And she would always come, she was wonderful actually. She'd come up with a huge list of, we should ask them this, that, and the other, which is, you know, absolutely the right thing to do. And we would ask them this, that, and the other, and we'd go backwards and forwards. And then it would always be, I don't think I'm ready to do it at the moment. Let's think about it next time. And so during the time I was managing her, she did very, very few performances, a few, televisions, recording, but not live performances.
Do you think that she would forget how much she enjoyed being on stage?
Yes, I do. I think the effort to get on stage outweighed the pleasures or the remembrance of the pleasures when she was on. Having to put on the makeup, having to put on, you know, the clothes, the hair, having to be scrutinized, it just became too much effort. And I actually do understand it. I think that she should have overcome it, and we all tried to help her overcome it and make it as pleasurable as possible. And when she was doing a television, there would be a team, you know, Debbie Dennell, who did her makeup, whoever was doing her hair, Pat, myself. I mean, a whole group of us would, you know, be around so that we could have some fun, we could have a giggle, we could make it as light and easy as possible. But at the end of the day, it was still Dusty that had to get herself together.
When did Dusty Springfield find out that she had cancer?
She called me up one day and said, at the end of the conversation, sort of very casually said, did I tell you that I found a lump in my breast? To which I said, no. And what did your doctor say? To which she said, I don't really have a doctor. I haven't been to see anybody. I said, Dust, get off the phone. Let me make you an appointment with mine. I'll call you right back. So I called my doctor, called her right back. 2 days later, we were in my doctor's office, and the doctor said, basically to all of us, yes, there is a lump. I want you to go and see Ian Smith at the Marsden. And we came out, and of course, there was the usual crowd of us, and went and had our usual cup of tea and said, well, it could be worse. At least, you know, they know the lump's there. Perhaps they can do something. They're sending you to a great specialist. And we were all trying to be, you know, incredibly optimistic. But of course, when she went to the Marsden, they said, yes, it is cancer. We need to shrink the lump, which they did. And then they do what they call is a lumpectomy, which they take the actual lump out. And at that stage, it hadn't spread into the glands or anything. Did chemo, did some radiation, and we thought she was clear, which was magnificent. So the record came out, did all the promotion, which must have been grueling for her, but, you know, thinking that she was absolutely okay. And then she went for a holiday in Ireland and started, strange, having some sort of cough. And when she came back, went back to check, and they said, yep, you know, it's come back and we need to be more aggressive this time around.
And so she took more aggressive chemo after that?
She did. And also, Dusty was a very well-informed person. And what she didn't know, she certainly would find out. She went to every possible source on the internet, friends, et cetera, to find out what treatment was effective, what could be done, what America was doing. Called several people in America and in hospitals and stuff and said, this is what, you know, I'm doing at the Marsden. Is there anything you would recommend? Just was really well informed, and to their credit, the Marsden were wonderful and tried a couple of things that hadn't been approved in England. They actually went to the association and got approval to use the drugs on Dusty, which was, you know, very brave and good of them, because I do think it's your choice what you want. But unfortunately, none of them did the trick.
How did she handle the news that the cancer had come back?
Scared as hell, as we all would be. But absolutely determined that she would beat it. I mean, she felt that she'd beaten it before. She felt that she'd basically in life had many close brushes with her life, that she'd always beaten it. She felt she was in great shape emotionally, just in her life in general, and that she would beat it.
Did she ever, by the way, come out as a lesbian?
No.
Even when she knew she was dying?
No. There was no, you know, in a way, there was sort of no interest in her from that point of view at that stage. The papers were interested in the cancer, and it never really cropped up.
Did she wish, do you think, that she could have been more honest about herself?
Yes, because she was a very outgoing person. She wasn't a secretive person at all. I'm quite sure that she wished she could have been.
You were at her funeral when she died?
Yes.
What was the funeral like, and was there any of her music that was played there?
Yes, I put it together with Simon Bell, the two of us, and I just said to Simon, you know, Dust was such a star, an artist, we have to just have a very grand funeral. And as you know, the body was put in an open horse-drawn carriage, which has stopped the traffic in Henley. And yes, it was all her music. We played Going Back, which is very apt, a Goffin and King song. And the coffin actually went out to You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. And as it came out of the church, the crowd outside, I'm only laughing because she would have loved it, broke into applause. And Elton said, it's the only funeral I've ever heard of that the coffin gets the applause. She would have definitely been chuffed and had a giggle.
Vicki Wickham, friend and manager of the late Dusty Springfield, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. She co-authored Springfield's authorized biography titled Dancing with Demons. Dusty Springfield's 1979 concert performance at the Royal Albert Hall has been recently released on CD and DVD.